Welcome to the Council of Trent podcast, a production of Catholic Answers.
Hey, everyone. Welcome back to Free for All Friday here at the Council of Trent podcast. I'm your host, Catholic Answers apologist and speaker, Trent Horn. Monday and Wednesday, we talk apologetics and theology. Friday, we talk about whatever I want to talk about. And I have an eclectic set of interests. One thing that I really enjoy is the mysterious, the unsolved. When I was a kid, I really enjoyed watching Unsolved Mysteries with Robert Stack. He was also an Airplane, by the way. Sightings, paranormal. I love that stuff. And of course, because I love that stuff, I really enjoy another podcast called Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. So I thought today it'd be fun to have Jimmy on to talk about the mysterious world of Jimmy Akin, if you will, because I think he and I have a lot in common when it comes to exploring the mysterious from a Catholic perspective. So, Jimmy, welcome back to the show.
Hey, my pleasure to be here, Trent.
All right, well, let's just jump right into it, because it really motivated me to want to talk to you about this in particular, about what you think about the mysterious, is that I feel like we have a lot in common when it comes to this. Like, I'll think of an episode idea for Free for All Friday. Oh, this is a really interesting topic I've loved reading about, and I'll research it. And in my research, I'll notice that you had already done an episode on it, or you're planning to do an episode on it. So I think we both enjoy looking at the mysterious, the paranormal, the odd, the fascinating. I think one thing that got me really interested in that, when I was 8 years old, my mom took me to Ripley's Believe It or Not, mm-hmm. the museum in San Francisco, actually. My first question would be, what kind of inspired you to want to do, well, tell us a little bit about Mysterious World, how you got into it, and what your background kind of is in the mysterious.
Okay, so like you, I've been fascinated with the mysterious my whole life. I'm a little bit older than you. I did go to one of the Ripley's Believe It or Not museums as a kid.
And oh,
wow. In the 70s, I would watch In Search Of with Leonard Nimoy, which was a show devoted to mysteries. In the 80s, there were Arthur C. Clarke's various shows. And then we eventually got Unsolved Mysteries with Robert Stack. As you mentioned, my wife was a big fan of that show, and I'd watch it with her. There were also lots of other documentaries on mysterious subjects back in the 70s, UFOs, Bigfoot, the Loch Ness Monster, things like that. And so it's been something that I've been interested in, you know, my whole life. A number of years ago, so I work with a network called StarQuest, which it explores the intersection of faith and pop culture. And a number of years ago, we were revitalizing our line of podcasts, and we were pitching ideas. And I mentioned the possibility of doing what's now Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, which is a show that looks at mysteries from the perspectives of faith and reason. And I had been thinking previously about writing a book on the subject, you know, like have a chapter on each chapter is a different mysterious subject, and then talk about, you know, it from the perspectives of faith and reason. And I decided to pitch it as a podcast. And so 4 years ago, we started, and we have grown to the point that we're in the top 25 documentary podcasts in the United
Wow.
States on Apple Podcast. We have something like 100,000 listeners per episode, and it's a lot of fun. Every Friday, we look at a new mystery. It can be a natural mystery, a supernatural mystery, a paranormal mystery, science, history, all kinds of things get involved.
And then how do you incorporate your faith into exploring the mysterious? Because I think that's what makes it interesting, that you don't check your faith at the door, but you also don't just resort to very, what some people might say, simplistic explanations that are faith-based. You really try to seek out a very nuanced explanation or possible explanations for mm-hmm. these strange things we come across.
Yeah. So on the show, I try to do two things. One of them is to model critical thinking skills. And that comes to the fore, particularly in the reason segment of the show. Every show we have two major perspectives. After we give the background for the mystery, we then consider it from the reason perspective, which is what can critical thinking tell us about this? To what extent can we solve this using reason? And then we also have a faith perspective where we say, well, okay, what would the Christian faith say about this? And in approaching it from the faith perspective, as you say, I do try to be nuanced about it. I don't leap to the explanation. It's always demons.
D.B. Cooper. I would say, how does faith, the hijacking of D.B. Cooper? He was a demon, obviously.
Yeah. So I try to think carefully and in line with Christian tradition. And Christian tradition is a lot more subtle on this than popular accounts would have you believe. Doctors of the church, like St. Augustine and St. Thomas Aquinas, for example, believed that God built into human nature what now we would consider psychic powers. Hmm. They both believed in precognition, which St. Thomas Aquinas called natural prophecy to distinguish it from the supernatural prophecy that God gives. Aquinas also believed in psychokinesis, or mind over matter, which was his explanation for what causes the evil eye. So one needs to, if one is deep in the tradition, one needs to think through these other possibilities and not just leap to it's always demons or what have you. In fact, in reading recent writings, the writings of recent exorcists, I've found them pointing out, you know, well, this thing might be psychic. It might not be a demon at all. Mm-hmm. And so I try to be very nuanced and informed in the approach I take rather than just going for easy explanations.
All right, let's hop into it. And I just want to hear from you kind of what are just some of your favorite mysteries that you have come across, or the most notable ones. I have different ones in these different categories, just to chat and see ones that you've really enjoyed exploring or found to be fascinating. And like you said earlier, there's different kinds. I mean, you have natural, it sounds like there's almost like three categories, like natural things, supernatural things, paranormal things. Maybe before I go to the go ahead, do you see what I'm saying? Like maybe, yeah. Are there different categories you might put the mysterious in?
Oh, I do put them in those categories. In fact, if you go to, I mean, people can go to the show by going to mysterious.fm. Mm-hmm. And there we have not only a list of all the previous shows, we also have a database where they're categorized. So if you're interested in cryptids, you can look at our previous cryptid episodes. That's like Bigfoot and the Loch Ness Monster. Mm-hmm. If you're interested in UFOs, you can look at those. If you're interested in religious mysteries, you can look at those. So absolutely, they do go into different categories.
So like a cryptid might be like a natural mystery, but a haunting, for example, or poltergeist, that might be more paranormal. Slash supernatural. Paranormal. Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, let's talk then a little bit about the paranormal. Like what are some of the most interesting paranormal investigations you've done?
Well, just recently I did an episode called The Haunted House of Marin County. Marin County is in California, and I interviewed an actual paranormal investigator who is a professional. I mean, he has a master's in parapsychology that's accredited.
Not just on the back of a cereal box.
Exactly. His name is Lloyd Auerbach, and he's a professor at the Ryan Education Center. And I've taken some of his courses, and I knew about this case that he had done where there was a there were reports. This was back in, I guess, the 1980s, of a house in Marin County that had some ghostly like phenomena occurring in it. And he was brought in to investigate it. And he and his team checked it out. And one of the things I wanted to do with this episode was show you the difference, or show the audience the difference between what real paranormal investigators do compared to what you see on ghost hunting shows. Because ghost hunting shows are trash. And like reality TV in general, right. Among other things, real paranormal investigators don't do their research in the dark, because humans are terrible observers in the dark. And so real paranormal investigators, like, why would we want to hamper ourselves by doing that? So,
because it's not as spooky, Jimmy.
Well, this is one of the conventions that, you know, kind of Hollywood has given us. Actually, the roots of doing like seances in the dark goes back to the 19th century when you had this spiritualist movement with a lot of what were called physical mediums. Physical mediums were people who would claim to contact spirits, and they would want to do it in the dark because the spirits would manifest in physical ways. It wasn't just talking on a spirit's behalf. The spirit would, you know, the spirits would play musical instruments.
Right.
And things like that. And it's a lot easier to fake that in the dark.
Right.
So that kind of became a trope, but real paranormal investigators don't do that. Well, in the case of the haunted house of Marin County, it turned out that there were no ghosts. Hmm. Instead, there were two different phenomena that were happening. The first one was a haunting. At least, I mean, this is what their evidence suggested. You could dispute this, but what their evidence suggested is that one of the phenomena was a haunting. And that term has a special meaning in parapsychology. A haunting is not the apparition of a ghost. It's not a ghost appearing. Instead, a haunting is thought of as kind of a place memory. It's like a recording that was laid down by someone when they were alive. And then that recording keeps playing, and this is held to be responsible for non-interactive ghosts. So you see someone, and they keep doing the same thing, and it's like they're not interacting, they're not thinking, what's going on here? They're acting like a recording. And in parapsychology, the term that's been applied to that is a haunting. And so this house had a couple of hauntings going on. One was there was this old couple that would sit on the porch in their porch swing and watch the sunset. And that turned out to be the former owners when they looked at pictures of people who had lived in the house before. They were identified, okay, the old couple is former owners. They're just enjoying the sunset. This is just a recording of what they would do when they were alive.
So it's like how people could leave a physical impression in a place. It's like they leave a psychic impression.
In essence, yes. Although there's a question about exactly what the storage medium is. Mm-hmm. There's some indication that hauntings may be related to magnetism. Mm. And so it's not entirely clear, but it's thought to be some kind of recording. Mm-hmm. After the original owners, the house was owned by a couple of different people who used it to engage in criminal activity. Mm. And that was responsible for another aspect of the hauntings that were seen at this place. Sometimes hauntings are thought to be laid down when something violent occurs, and there had been violence in the house. And so that was part of it as well. But then in addition to the hauntings, there was a separate phenomenon. The woman of the household would see this like 6-year-old little girl playing with her sons. And she thought, okay, this is a neighborhood kid, just playing with my sons. Her sons were like 4 years old and 2 years old. And she didn't think anything of it until the little girl vanished in front of her
like
eyes.
I don't like where the story's going. It's creepy.
Actually, it's not as creepy as you'd think.
Okay.
Because they found out who the little girl was. Mm. And the little girl was alive. She was 90 years old and living up the street in hospice care. And when she was under her meds, she was sleeping a lot because she had cancer, and she was under medication for the pain. When she would sleep, she would appear. So this is an apparition. Mm-hmm. This is a living apparition because the person's alive. She would appear at her old home where she used to live.
Yeah.
And she appeared as a little girl and played with the boys. And when they found out who she was, they went up the street and they met her, and she knew the little boys from when she was asleep. And so this was a case of a living apparition, which is another phenomenon that's reported in parapsychology. In fact, there over 100 years ago, there were a couple of books that came out called Phantasms of the Living that documented a lot of cases like this. And These sometimes occur in crisis situations where a person is dying and they appear to their loved ones, or they're in some kind of emergency and their loved ones see them. And in those cases, it's called a crisis apparition.
Yeah, I've heard of those.
Yeah, but in this case, it was just she's asleep and she's appearing down the street where she used to live and meeting the nice family that lives there now. At least that's what the evidence suggested.
Have you ever been to the Whaley House in San Diego?
I've been by the Whaley House. I plan to do an episode on it, but I haven't dug into it yet.
Okay, yeah, because that's like a famous haunted house there. And when I used to live there, I would go every now and then because I'm interested in these things. I loved going during Halloween. They would open it up at night. For me, I mean, I enjoyed the paranormal investigation, but as a theater student, I also like just the air that they put on in the house and things like that. But I also want to follow up. I think it's hard. Some people might hear these things, and even Catholics, and just say, oh, that's a bunch of hooey. How it's gullible to believe that, these kinds of things. But I always find it interesting, either atheists or Catholics or whoever, having a knee-jerk reaction that the world could not be a certain way. Now, I believe in assessing the evidence. And sometimes I think people are so oddly closed-minded when the world just seems way more complicated and unknown than we realize. I don't know if you sense that frustration too.
Oh, sure. We live in a very secular culture that has a bias in favor of materialism, and that even applies to Christians. But if you go deep into the tradition, you find out that this is a very modern idea, that these things can't happen and that they don't happen. Aquinas, for example, believed not only that God can allow human spirits to appear to us, but that he can allow not just the saints to appear, but souls in purgatory and even the souls of the damned. Mm-hmm. And so so this is something that has been reported all through human history. It's reported in all different cultures. This is not culture dependent. It's a human universal. Mm-hmm. And our culture tends to dismiss it, but it's actually reported a lot more than you hear about because the press just wants to poo-poo it and and dismiss it.
Right. Let's move on then to maybe we could talk about some natural mysteries, because mm-hmm. on the show you cover, there's all kinds of things. And these are things that I love talking about on my podcast as well, like mysterious disappearances or unexplained artifacts or buildings that are discovered. There are things where there's not necessarily a connection to supernatural or even paranormal. It's just weird things. We still don't know what happened. Kind of, you know, unsolved mm-hmm. mysteries. You know, so what are some notable ones there that you've looked into?
Well, there are a couple of unsolved mysteries that I've put on the show already that are very similar in a way. One of them is the Somerton Man case, which was about this guy down in Australia. He did not appear to be an Australian, and he died on a beach, and he left behind a code.
I've heard of this one. This is why I'm so excited about this. Yeah.
Yeah, so he left behind a code, and there were witnesses that emerged later that talked about what he'd been doing, and it's not clear who he was, but there is significant, this was back in the 1940s,
right.
And there's significant evidence he may have been a spy, mm-hmm. and he may have either been killed or killed himself in order to get out of a situation. And the good news is that there are now they've exhumed his remains to take a DNA test. And with modern public DNA database matching, we may finally find out who this guy was.
Yeah.
And which could then shed light on additional things. There's a very similar case that happened in Norway in the 1970s. And in this case, it was a woman. She was definitely not Norwegian. Mm-hmm. And she showed up in a place called Isdalen, or Ice Valley. And she turned up dead in Ice Valley. She had been staying in hotels and meeting with people and being rather secretive. She had some strange behavior that she would do in the hotels, like she would She would take a letter off the bathroom door and put it on her own door. She would rearrange the furniture. She would do all kinds of stuff.
Yeah.
And again, and she also had a what turned out, they thought at first it was a code. It really was just abbreviations. But she had this travel itinerary indicating that she'd been going all over Europe. And one of the likely hypotheses is that she was also a spy and that she was a courier, which explains her travel movements. And she got in over her head. She likely was spying. It's not clear who she was spying for, but there, Norway during the Cold War, now they're talking about joining NATO right now, but during the Cold War, they cooperated with NATO and they had missile systems that they were testing, and she seemed to be observing the missile systems. And so the Ice Valley woman is another unexplained natural case where we may eventually get some closure, because she also had DNA that she left behind. And there are efforts to try to run a DNA test on her. Thus far, they haven't done that.
Yeah.
But it may happen in the near future, in which case we could find out who she was and where she was from as well.
Yeah, I think there's another case like this. Maybe a spy, maybe not. I think it was here in the US. A guy was found dead, but he had a note in his pocket that had some kind of cryptography that people are still trying to, and you know, you find dead John Doe's, it's not uncommon, but someone to have a note in their pocket that has a code that cryptographers can't seem to break, that's where it gets notable.
Yeah. Speaking of codes, this is one that I haven't yet put on the show, but I've done a lot of research on it. Another unsolved mystery that I look forward to covering on the show is the Zodiac Killer.
Oh, yeah.
I've done a lot of research into the Zodiac Killer. He was, for people who may not be familiar, he was a serial killer that lived in Northern California, up around the Bay Area, in the late 1960s. And he, at times, would... In one of his encounters, and in this case, one of the people survived and is still with us, but he like put on an executioner's costume that he had apparently made himself. He also taunted the police with codes that he would send out to newspapers. And just recently, one of his codes that had been unbroken for 50 years was finally broken.
Oh, wow.
And it continued with his ramblings. He believed, or at least he claimed to believe, that he was collecting slaves for his afterlife, that everybody he killed would have to serve him in the afterlife. And it's not clear if he really believed that or if that was like a pretext for an insanity defense in case he got caught.
Right.
But it was the kind of thing he talked about in his codes.
Another one for me, and I know you've covered this on the show, I've covered it on my episodes as well, is the case of the toxic woman.
That oh, is, yeah. Gloria Ramirez.
Yeah. So that was a woman who was like, I think it was at a hospital, like in Riverside.
Riverside. Yeah.
Yeah. Riverside, California. She's admitted. And then, and you know, you'll have more details off the top of your head than me, but a lot of people started to become sick after she was admitted. A lot of different hospital staff, they had to evacuate. And then the big debate is like, well, is this a case of mass hysteria, or did this woman have some kind of strange interaction with the medicine they administered that secreted a toxic substance? And so that's an interesting, was it mass hysteria or not cases?
Yeah. And in that case, so those were the kind of the two hypotheses that were out in public and that have gotten the most attention. I think the actual solution to that case is something else.
Really?
Because Riverside County, California at the time was considered the methamphetamine capital of the world. And it looks like someone was cooking meth in the hospital.
Oh.
And they may have been trying to smuggle it out of the hospital in IV bags. And when Gloria Ramirez was brought in for treatment, they may have grabbed one of the wrong bags, and it was the methamphetamine precursor in the bag that caused people to start getting sick. And when it was exposed in contact with the air, because what they do it was after they gave her an IV that right. people start keeling over. And what they do when they hook up an IV mm-hmm. is they want to get the air out of the IV line. And so they squeeze the bag and release some of the, in an emergency room setting, they right. squeeze the bag to push all the air out of the line. And that releases some of the supposed saline that's right. in the bag.
Oh, wow.
But if it's meth precursor, it can have a caustic effect on people and cause them to start choking and coughing and passing out and things like that.
Yeah. Oh, I did not hear of that alternative explanation. Because for me, I feel like mass hysteria is just a very weak, I feel like that's kind of a throwaway explanation in a lot of cases when like, mm-hmm. especially when, and now that can happen, and you've probably covered this, and I've covered this on my show, examples of mass panic, mass hysteria. But it's these kinds of explanations that should be doled out carefully. I mean, it's interesting. I guess when you're doing your investigations, I'm sure you apply probably a principle like Occam's razor when you're trying to figure these things out.
Yeah, the simplest explanation is usually correct.
Mm-hmm.
That
fits the facts. Yeah, you don't want to be too overly simplified because then you might miss things. Last one. So we've got paranormal, unsolved mysteries, kind of another kind of natural mystery, but one that's always fascinating to look into are conspiracy theories. People allege there are real conspiracies. We've discovered mm-hmm. them. But then there's other cases where people claim there's a conspiracy and there's a dispute about whether there's a conspiracy that's involved. And that gets into all kinds of interesting stuff. So what can you tell us about some of those you've enjoyed looking at?
Well, so some of them are called conspiracies. It's not 100% clear that they would technically be conspiracies. In United States law, a conspiracy is an agreement between two or more people to do something illegal in the future. And obviously those exist. That's why we have laws against them. Mm. There are various groups like Bohemian Grove and the World Economic Forum that meets at Davos and the Bilderberg Group and so forth that bring together the rich and powerful, and they talk to each other and they make plans and things like that. And it's often said that they're up to no good. And frequently that, you know, I think there are elements of truth in that, mm-hmm. Like the Great Reset, for example, is a project that the World Economic Forum has proposed as a way of exploiting the COVID situation to build back better mm-hmm. and advance their agenda. And so it's not a conspiracy in the sense they're doing anything illegal, because they don't appear to be, but it is something that is a source of concern whenever you have rich and powerful people getting together behind closed doors to make plans. It's a source of concern. Adam Smith himself, the father of capitalism, said, you know, you can't even let businessmen get together for a social function without it turning into a conspiracy against the public.
Right.
And so I've talked about those. In terms of actual or potentially actual conspiracy theories, one of the most fascinating, I think, is what happened with the JFK assassination. This is one I talked about early on. And my conclusion is that neither side on this is crazy. There's enough evidence to support either the hypothesis that Lee Harvey Oswald acted alone mm-hmm. or that he was enmeshed in a conspiracy and may have just been the patsy that he said he was, because he didn't act like a typical assassin. I mean, after John Wilkes Booth shot Abraham Lincoln, he leaps on the stage at Ford's Theater and says, "Sic semper tyrannis," you know, thus always to tyrants. Assassins who are mad enough to kill somebody
right.
tend to want to take credit for it.
Right.
And Oswald didn't. He said that he hadn't shot anybody and he was just a patsy. And there's some evidence to support that. So there's just been so much on the JFK assassination and surrounding events mm-hmm. that it could go in any number of directions. In fact, this year I'm looking at another aspect of the case where Oswald apparently tried to assassinate a former general of who lived in Dallas at the time, and General Edwin Walker. And so I talk about that, and I talk about the different interpretations that have been offered of it, including an interpretation offered by the former CIA director, James Woolsey, who believes that Oswald's attempted assassination of General Walker was a test to see if he'd go through with assassinating a public figure prior to the Kennedy assassination.
Administered by other people in a conspiracy.
Administered by the Kremlin.
Oh.
And according to Woolsey and his co-author, who was a former Soviet bloc intelligence general, according to them, Nikita Khrushchev ordered the Kennedy hit because of, among other things, the humiliation that Khrushchev suffered at the during the Cuban Missile Crisis. And then it got called off, but Oswald went through with it anyway. And so so that's what we'll be talking about this November for the Kennedy assassination. Today on Mysterious World, we're starting to look at the Cuban Missile Crisis itself.
Yeah.
Because there is a fascinating story there. A lot of people, you know, have been asking about, okay, so the situation with Russia and Ukraine right now, could that lead to nuclear war? And so I wanted to look at the Cuban Missile Crisis as one of the previous times that we have come close to nuclear war. There's a lot that happened that the public did not know about, including the American public, because the Kennedy brothers lied about the deal. We actually struck a different deal with the Soviet Union that was not publicly announced. And it's what left Khrushchev with egg on his face after the crisis was over. And the secret deal was something else. And so we're going to be talking about that.
Wow. You could do, actually, I might do this for a future Free For All Friday. I'd love to see you covered as well in Mysterious World. But that the Cuban Missile Crisis reminds me that there are several different episodes during the Cold War and before and after where we had nuclear close calls.
Yeah.
One of my favorites is when I think it was like a B-52 crashed in North Carolina carrying a hydrogen bomb, and five of the six fail safes on the bomb failed and only one of them kept the bomb from detonating on American soil.
Yeah, there have been that's called when that happens, that's known as a broken arrow. And when
it's also a great movie with Christian Slater, by the way. So, in case.
Okay, I thought it was Steven Seagal, but maybe he's in there too.
I want to say that they're both. But go on, Broken Arrow.
Yeah, so when a nuclear weapon is lost track of, it's known as a broken arrow, and sometimes they almost go off, and that's happened here in the United States. It happened in the Mediterranean. It happened in Iceland. Fortunately, in those situations, they didn't go off, but they could have, and that would have been very dangerous. During the Cold War itself, there was one particular day known in hindsight as Black Saturday. The Cuban Missile Crisis went on for about 2 weeks. And one of the Saturdays in there was so bad, we almost went to nuclear war like three times the same day.
Wow. Yeah. Oh, and looking up here, Broken Arrow was John Travolta, Christian Slater, and Howie Long. You might be thinking of Executive Decision, which was with Steven Seagal, where they're in the stealth plane and they got to get on the plane that's been hijacked by terrorists. That's another great one. We should just do one on the rise and fall of Steven Seagal. Would be another episode that could be done. Tracy,
I'd have to do some research for that. I know his name. I know he's an action hero type actor, but beyond that, I don't know too much.
Sure thing. It's just so funny. The things that it kind of reminds me of. Did you see the original Men in Black with?
Tommy Lee Jones and Will Smith.
Yeah. I love when he finds out about the aliens and they're sitting in the park and he's like, why don't you tell anybody? And it's like, 1500 years ago, people found out about the, Earth being flat. And he's wrong about these things, but whatever. 1500 years ago, we found out the world was round. 500 years ago, sun grows on the Earth. 5 minutes ago, you just learned that there was intelligent life in other planets. What will you find out tomorrow? It's this idea that there are these so many, we think we know the world and even among the natural facts of history that just the general public isn't aware of, there's so many things we don't know that make it so much richer and interesting. And so I think it's neat for you to be able to share that on your show.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
Very good. Well, Jimmy, thank you so much. Where can people, just to remind our listeners, go to learn more about Mysterious World?
Well, they can always go to my personal website, jimmyakin.com, which is kind of a hub for all my activities. But if they want to go specifically to Mysterious World, they can go to mysterious.fm. And they also can go to my YouTube channel, which is youtube.com/jimmyakin, because these days we have a video version of the podcast and we have animations and diagrams and all kinds of visual aids to help enhance the information we're delivering by audio.
That's great. So everyone definitely go check out Jimmy's YouTube channel and their podcast, Mysterious World. I'll link to both of those in the description below, but definitely go and check those out. So thank you so much, Jimmy, and glad to have you. Hope to have you back again sometime.
Thank you. My pleasure.
If you like today's episode, become a premium subscriber at our Patreon page and get access to member-only content. For more information, visit TrentHornPodcast.com.